So by the end of this talk, you will have made it halfway through. That might feel good to hear. So good to sit in the interviews and the meetings that we had today. It's very informative. It also makes one have to write Dharma talks at the last minute. Interesting moment I find myself in frequently. So tonight's talk, I always like to say what I'm going to talk about. I don't think I've ever done one of these before. It's going to be called Our Ultimate Concern. So just kind of hearing that question. So I'm going to try to ask lots of questions and answer them on my own, because I feel this is this practice we're doing is very reflective. And it's not about actually, it's not so much about having the answer, or finding the answer, or what's the answer, but it's really a much more of a question-asking practice. Because really, having the answer is just a mild form of clinging, isn't it? I don't know about you, but once I feel like I have the answer to a question, I stop asking the question. And that we can find it in our lives, at times in our lives, that we feel like we have all the right answers to all the wrong questions. I think much of the world is in this currently. And sometimes we'll even settle for some really, like, really half-assed, not good answer at all. Settle. I'll settle for this, I'll settle for that. So just kind of thinking about that in a subjective way, I think there's a lot to be learned and respected about our own subjective reality and our own histories and what we've been through. And as much as Dharma practice or meditation can be an objective view on experience, that subjectiveness always kind of creeps in a little bit. And so we can get into this slippery slope sometimes when we hear things like anatta or teachings on not self, and we think that we need to be above ourselves and that our experiences don't matter so much, our histories and so forth, they're not important. But that's not really the case, I don't think, and I think that that's a big misperception about practice in general. And I find the way that they hold this in like a gestalt method of therapy is this idea that I like in the middle of this is nothing's irrelevant, none of this is irrelevant, and none of it's that important. Right? So how do we not dismiss any of the data or any of the experiences that arise as we practice, but how do we not get caught into trying to figure out, well, this is really important, or this is... It's that there's somewhere we're in the middle of trying to sort that out through an objective lens of mindfulness, awareness, seeing thoughts and emotions as emotions. The in-breath as the in-breath and the out-breath as the out-breath. There's a lot of objective things we can learn to pay attention to and observe. But again, the subjectiveness always kind of creeps in. So we ask ourselves that question, what is your ultimate concern? There's probably as many ultimate concerns as there are people in the room. That I just want to be happy. I just want to find love. I just want to be loved. I just want to have meaning and purpose. I just want to have some connection. I just want to understand what it means to be here. No, probably a little bit of all of those, right? And so this is what drives our lives, is this question, what is it that is our ultimate concern? What is it that we're most concerned with on a deep or true level? And we actually might find that we keep that private. We maybe don't want people to actually know what our primary or ultimate concern is. Maybe we feel embarrassed about it, or we think it's foolish, or we think it won't happen. We might even feel some degree of shame around that. And so we don't, there's a not knowing that happens in that. We don't really want to, we kind of want to stay in denial about that at times, sometimes. And what is it that we're most concerned with? And then we come to a practice like this, and the other question I like to ask is, how'd you get here? Of all the things to do on a weekend in November. And I would argue and I would suspect that there's some degree of your ultimate concern that put you in a position where something like this has become interesting, or you're curious about that, a practice like this. What is it that drives one to the point where they're just willing to sit quietly and stare at their mind all day? Blast house on the street. Or probably more like the shack in the woods behind the last house on the street. What is that out there? Tried all these other houses. And so, you know, what has been our primary dissatisfaction, perhaps? You know, what are the events of your life? What is the history of your life? What are the insights that you've had that put you in a position where this has become something to explore? This practice of, sometimes I don't even know what we're doing here. Are we breathing? Are we being kind? Paying attention? Not judging? What's the gist of it? And of course, it would be so nice to boil it down to a one thing, but there's no such thing as a one thing. We find that we are in this complex matrix of past and future and emotion and thoughts and concerns and dissatisfactions and hopes and fears, kind of unfolding one at a time. And, you know, what do we hope to accomplish? What do we want to accomplish in this endeavor? Is it something that we just want to understand? What are we trying to accomplish here? What are we trying to understand? Is it even realistic? Lots of important questions. Questions upon questions. Inquiry. Investigation. So part of what we're doing is we're inquiring into what matters most, what gets in the way, what can we expect to accomplish, where do we have agency, what do we have agency over, what don't we have any agency over? Where can we intervene? All these questions. And so then we go to the from the subjective to the objective experience of Dharma, of the Buddhist endeavor, and like to ask a series of questions in association with that, because I have found in the last several years of my practice I have this sort of strange curiosity with this historic figure, the Buddha, the Siddhartha Gautama, as really wanting to understand him as a human, really wanting to understand the humanity of what he went through. And of course, as Buddhism moves from region to region and various practices get developed, he becomes less and less human as on and on it goes. And then we get to this kind of idea of enlightenment, or that there is not even an unpleasant thought in the mind of the enlightened Buddha. It sounds like Buddhist heaven. This blissed out, checked out mind state where no pain or dissatisfaction arises. And if that's the bar, someone give me a ride to the airport right now, because I'm ready to go. So who was he? Of course we don't know. But we do know that he had, like us, certainly some kind of crisis, some kind of concern about life, that things didn't seem right, or he wasn't very happy with the answers that he was getting to some of the primary questions about, you know, the big questions that are mostly dangerous to ask is there life after death? Is there life before death? Is the mind and body the same or the mind and body different? All these really esoteric questions that frankly nobody has any idea what the answer to those questions are. But we do know a little bit about his time and place. And his time and place, you know, was ancient India. He grew up in probably a fairly wealthy family. He would have had access to sort of the best food and medicine and education at his time. He would have been in a tribe. His family would have been more tribal. They certainly didn't live in a palace, which is the historic story that he grew up in this fancy palace where he was sheltered from the world. And there were no palaces back in ancient India, as we know. So that couldn't have happened. I don't know where that story came from. But he definitely, we don't know much about his early life, but we know two specific events that I think are important or interesting, perhaps. And that he, at the age of 12 or 13, had this experience sitting under a rose apple tree when his father was plowing the fields or working the fields, where he slipped into this kind of experience where he felt connected, he felt at ease, he felt like he had woken up to a way of being or a way of operating that felt different than anything that he had felt before. We might just say he probably fell into a meditative state, a state of collectedness, ease, samadhi. Probably no different than any experiences that many of you probably had today. Not necessarily a privileged or special state of mind, but an ordinary kind of connected to the present time experience, not ultimately concerned with the past or the future. Not dictated by craving or fear or wanting. Just a kind of, pretty good to be here. And he remembered that. He actually, as his teachings go on, he reflects back on that moment many times. And we know in his late teens or early 20s, he had some kind of internal crisis or something happened where he left his home and he left his family, he left his wife and his child, and he set out to come to terms with what's historically known as birth, old age, sickness, and death, the reality that he knew, like everybody else, he was going to die. And he seemed to notice that people wasted their time and there was no answers to be found. And why do people suffer so much, I think, was his primary concern. I think his, and of course, I don't know. But somebody who spent 45 years teaching suffering and the end of suffering must have somehow been concerned about this suffering business. And I think in a very real way, in his own experience, he noticed and he recognized that he himself, like everybody else, seemed to suffer in ways that were very, very unnecessary. Quite unnecessary. And that as a result of that, people kill each other, they harm each other, they engage in all kinds of destructive behaviors. And I think he had a sort of snapshot into humanity, probably in a way that shook him to some degree, in some type of a existential crisis, where he was moved to ask the question, I wonder if there's anything you can like do about that. Are we just like stuck with these, you know, these craving, greedy minds? Are we just born into this horrible contraption and just kind of do our best to get through and then die and hope it all works out in the end? Is that what we're doing? Or is there something that can be done to change the course of one's life? Are there things that we can do to not control, but to influence outcome? Do we have influence over our well-being? And again, this is the complete opposite of the way we view mental health in our culture, where we pathologize and we diagnose and we medicate and we... every single unskillful, unwholesome, destructive mind state, emotion, or behavior has a statistical diagnostic manual to describe what that is. So we've pathologized suffering. And we medicate suffering. And so we're very much interested in the kind of how bad people do. And why do they do so bad? And how can we medicate? And how can we profit off of that? And in Buddhist practice, is very much interested in how good can people do, based on their own accord, on their own effort, in their own experience. How well can one actually do? And you know, the 2,600 year tradition, 20 something schools of Buddhism. World figures like the Dalai Lama, you know, there's this whole plethora of ideas and practices that are primarily concerned with how well people can do. And so interesting, all of us find ourselves in kind of the middle of that, right? Like, which one is it? Am I mostly concerned with how I can become attentive and focus on and get wrapped up in all of my anguishes and diagnoses and afflictive emotions and mind states, or maybe I can just put that aside and start looking at what I can do to overcome that. And so I think this very idea was what moved this individual to go out and check out what was available at his time and his place. And the world was the God figure of the day was this guy figure named Brahma. And so we have things like the Upanishads and the Jains and Hinduism and all of the traditions of his time were trying to, so we could basically say that was the God figure of the time. And he learned all these different types of concentration practices and learned, and from what we understand, developed and practiced all of the different spiritual, meditative traditions that were available at his time and became very quite skilled in all of them, but was dissatisfied with all of them. He's like, well, this is like, yes, I can sit and temporarily get into a concentrated state and feel bliss and all of these kinds of things. And then when the meditation is over, when the bell rings, you know, I'm just back to me and my dissatisfactions and my concerns and my worries and my fears. It didn't do anything. It just gave me temporary relief from all of that. And so again, I feel like this was maybe 6 or 7 years, he was doing that. And he tried this asceticism where he denied the body of all of its food and sustenance. And I would imagine it came to another type of crisis of like, nobody seems to have any clue. Nobody even seems actually all that concerned. Everybody seems to be caught up in trying to break through to dwell with Brahma. These spiritual traditions. And our world's like that too. We have the dichotomy now, of course, there's the Judeo-Christian religion system that many of us probably dealt with and deal with growing up. And then we also have this capitalism thing, where it's just like where we've externalized happiness through products and consumerism and through trying to make good and do well in the world. And if we can just do well in the world, then that will actually bring our disquietude to an end. The religion of capitalism. And so, you know, what happened to this guy? What did he do? It's a sort of, and I think in a very pragmatic way, in a very real way, is I get the sense of him in his total frustration. Just, you know, the story, of course, is he sat under this tree. He was just like, actually probably was really tired and frustrated and sat under a tree. And just, you know, he just started watching his mind. You know, and he, when people would ask him what happened to him or what his experience was, he would use this word bodhi. He would just say, I'm awake. And that was not a term that they used at that time. Actually, interestingly enough, to take a side note, one of the things that would have been very prevalent in the culture of his time from a spiritual religious tradition is that if you met somebody, if you were a practitioner, in kind of a nice thing to say, would say, may you dwell with Brahma. Mm. That would be in kind of the nicety of the time. May you be one with Brahma. May you dwell with Brahma. Which actually is where we get this term Brahma Vihara. So he didn't use that kind of language to describe what his experience was. He used this word Bodhi, wake, I woke up. I'm awake now. I'm seeing the mind for what it is. And that's really, when he talks about his Dharma, when he talks about Dharma, which is an almost impossible word to translate, sort of the Buddhist thing. The Buddha has his thing. He's in the Dharma thing. That's like his gig. It's his deal. That's about as descriptive as I can get, actually. It's the Buddha's thing. That Buddha guy, he does the Dharma. That's his thing. What is that thing? I'm interested in that thing. Well, you got to sit down and watch your mind. And that sounds hard. Just give me the thing. What's the one thing? Dharma. What's the Dharma thing? I want to do that thing. So he uses this language of having woken up. And I don't think it's so important, actually, what he woke up to, but it actually might be more interesting to what he woke up from. What is the experience of being asleep? And that's that sense of that disconnection from life itself. And I think humans have just enough of self-awareness to just make this whole thing a big, big mess. Right? We have just enough self-awareness. It's like our prefrontal cortex, you know, it's like they didn't finish it. It's like, you know, they, you know what I mean? They like they started putting it together, and then the dude who was doing the design just like was gone. He's like, they'll figure it out. And we're just like, fuck, dude, this is like really weird. I'm like me, and it's just me and you, and I don't like it in here. Think about some other place to be, some other person to be, some other experience to have. And so we have this like, and this is interesting too, because neuroscience is going this way, is that we have this like abundance of real estate, kind of more like software in our system, that we actually have to learn how to access and use and manage and sort out. And I think that's pretty much what the Buddha woke up to. He's like, oh, you don't have a lot of agency here, folks, but you have some. In fact, when you realize how little you have, you might just become very disappointed and want to go back to sleep. It's like the Matrix. You know, maybe the digital steak's not so bad after all. When you're down in the metal crappy ship eating the like cold oatmeal drool. Right? It's like, oh man, I thought it was going to be better than this. Do all this hard work now. And so we find that we kind of switch on and off. We wake up, we fall asleep, we wake up, we fall asleep, we wake up, we fall asleep all the time. And that's, I think, what happened for him. And I think that's what happens for us, is we have these, throughout our lives, we probably, if you go back through your history, through your life, you probably can track or reflect on or name some specific moments where things took a kind of turn for the worse, for the better, for the different, for the whatever. You're like, oh, wait a minute here. There's something else going on. So we become less preoccupied with the other and this what drives our suffering. This word craving, which is not a great term, because I think craving, we just think about it in too much of a barbaric sense. But this just wanting other. That's that basic experience, that moment of just wanting other. And there's a lot of other things that one could want. And because we have this self-awareness and we have imagination and we can reflect on the past and we can imagine there being a future, there's endless possibilities of things that we can imagine that would be different than what's happening and how much better that would be if only. Imagination is not always good. And there's this, I forget what school it is, but there's this line in Tibetan Buddhism that says, unreal imagination exists. Think about that for a second. Unreal imagination. It exists. How much of your suffering is imagined? 90%? And so you wake up to that. Oh, whoa. I'm back. We're back now. Okay, good. This is your life. This is it. Welcome to it. It's not so bad. You know? Could be better. Yeah. And so we kind of have to come to terms, I think, with just the ordinariness. You know, that life is actually really quite ordinary. And then we kind of wake up to that. So then, well, how do you do that? You know, that's the other question. And so I think this, you know, and whether the Buddha sat under a tree and is all unfolded in one moment, who knows what really happened. But certainly this individual developed this dharmic system for understanding the mind. So dharma practice, Buddhist teachings, have a very organized psychological component. It has a very clear ethical component. It has this meditative training component. And so whatever happened for this individual, he organized experience in a way that is just, I just can't even believe. It's like mental trigonometry, mental emotional trigonometry. Everything is categorized. Everything is explained. Everything is, to some degree, clearly laid out. Everything is very well mapped. All for the sole purpose of cultivating well-being. The sole purpose, the primary, ultimate concern was to be free from this unnecessary suffering that we create and how one can do that. And then spent 45 years traveling about and teaching this to people. You know, and this just kind of unfolds and unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. It's such a slow grind, though, I have to tell you. It's this thing that they talk about sometimes in Zen. The Zen master Dogen talks about of this immediate awakening and then this gradual cultivation. So that we do have these moments where we wake up, right? Whether it's big, subtle, gross, small. You know, I feel like I use this term. I feel like a pretty unlucky individual. If you looked at my biopsychosocial, you would think, oh my God, this poor bastard. If you look at my file, you would think, oh man. In fact, the first time I got a trauma assessment about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, the trauma therapist, who's actually a good friend of mine now, ironically, put the thing aside and she looked at me and she said, wow. She said, you're really well adjusted. I was like, really? You think so? Because I was like, thank you so much for saying that. And it was funny because she became very interested in Buddhism right away. She's like, wow. She's like, he's got to be meditating for a while. Maybe there's something to this meditation business racket. And I was like, yeah. I was like, I'm really not that well adjusted right now, and that's why I'm in your office. But thank you for the compliment. Yeah. But I have really good Dharma karma. Mm-hmm. I've been very lucky in Dharma. It's been one of the areas of my life I've been very, very lucky. I was introduced to it at a very, very early age. I was 19 years old. And so I've had this really great, if I track it, I've had this really, when moments of my suffering in my life have been at a very, very high, unreasonable volume, it's always been right, there's always been some kind of dharmic intervention around that time for me. I've been so lucky that way. The first time when I was 19 and I was really, really suffering after a series of deaths and just having gone through a really horrible accident, that I met my first Dharma teacher and just kind of explained some of this stuff to me and said, yeah, like suffering's like a thing that people have to deal with, and there's things you can do about it. So I got this, you know, I jokingly like to say that I've been chasing the first breath for 24 years. Because actually the first time I did these practices, the first time I sat in the hall at Insight Meditation Society and sat across from this teacher, Stephen Smith, who still teaches in Asia, you know, who did the basic instructions. You know the drill, bring attention to your breathing when you notice your mind wanders. It's like, dude, that blew my mind. Blew my mind. I was like, you mean there's an exit door? Even for like 2 moments? So I had this really, really great transformative dharmic transmission early on that just convinced me, like, to no avail that this was a thing to, this was a worthwhile endeavor. And I didn't stay with it, you know. I've fallen back asleep many, many times for years and years and years. And I've had really, really, when I met Noah Levine, I was just got divorced and I was living in Nashville. I was like, I just, like, every time the suffering is at an unreasonable volume, some Dharma situation kind of prevails. So I've been very, very lucky that way. So I've had these kind of sudden awakening moments. And then the thing about it, though, the rub of it is, though, it's like you have that, and then it's like, okay, well, now you got it. You have to do all this work to maintain it. Mm-hmm. It's very fleeting. You know, we've all had these aha moments, right? They last not very long, maybe minutes, an hour. It does have a radical shift in our perspective, but we have to maintain that. And in the practice, we would call that right view or complete view. Is that there's periods in our life where we see the whole complete picture. Right, we see the whole complete picture. And instead of this little limited frame that we find in our practice, right? So in every moment we could say we're trying to cultivate or practice a right view, a completely accurate, ethical way of viewing experience, which is the nature of this this retreat, this metta vipassana, or this kind awareness, or this way of trying to see things. And we get it wrong most of the time. It's hard to see the complete picture. But just times that we do see the complete picture. And so we have this. Now, how do you do that? Right. You have to work at it, and we have this mindfulness. So I think, you know, we could say that the Buddha was the first mindfulness practitioner. I don't know whether we could say that he invented it, except for that he maybe discovered it. He was like, wait a minute, you can totally like watch this TV of the mind. You can watch, you can see, you can watch. Right? And that's kind of what we're learning to try to do here, is trying to watch, to monitor, to objectively monitor. Vipassana, to see into. Right? It takes a lot of, you know, you gotta kind of line things up pretty good. You gotta get a little bit concentrated, but not too concentrated. And one of his teachings that the Buddha talks to is, he says, the reason why people can't do this or see this Dharma, in one of his suttas, he talks about this Dharma that he awoke to, that he discovered. And he talks about how he woke up to it and that he discovered it, not that like he invented it. But he was like, oh, there's a way in which you can watch. He's like, but it's really hard to do because we're so preoccupied with our place. He talks about this idea of there being a place and a ground. And the ground is present moment awareness. The ground is the four foundations of mindfulness. The ground is dependent origination. The ground is what's happening right now. Right? We can sit around here and think, oh man, I was on a retreat, there's nothing happening. I'm gonna do something better, a better place to be. Have you noticed how much is going on? I mean, I sit down and close my eyes and it's just like, there's a lot of stuff happening. But what we have to do to be able to see that ground, to wake up to that ground, to see the interplay of events, we have to give up or renounce this idea of a place. And so he says that we don't see this, we don't wake up to this. People basically aren't interested in this because they're so preoccupied with their place. You know, that can be a lot of things. Your place could be just be yourself. I'm this person in this world who doesn't understand this world. This world doesn't understand me. This is a bad world. It's not been good to me. This place is a bad place. My status in the world, my job, my career, my relationship status, all these places. We're so preoccupied. I got to get to the right place. Wrong place at the wrong time. I'm always in the wrong place at the wrong time. I gotta get to a destination. We're so preoccupied with some destination. Gotta get to the place, gotta do the thing. Right? And then we kind of come here, and the retreat experience is so rich because a lot of the things that pull us into the place, seeking, finding, having, getting, becoming, is kind of eliminated. Right? We talked about this in the interviews. About place and time, the pressure of time and place. I gotta get to this place on time. You know, I gotta graduate college by 22 and have a degree by this and my master's by this and we're constantly moving any sense of freedom or hope or meaning that we could have in this present moment experience out into the place. And people spend their whole lives doing this craving to become, becoming. And the Buddha calls this paradox of becoming. Am I becoming preoccupied with the place to be, to get, to have, to become? Or am I becoming, bhavana, cultivating presence and ease? Coming back to this place. Coming back to the here and the now, waking up. And so this preoccupation with a place, with a destination, with something to get, to have, to become, to be better, to be the better. It's got to be better. There's got to be a better. It's got to be something better than this, right? And I'm going to fucking find it before all of you. And there's 7 billion people running around like lunatics on the planet trying to get to the right place before everybody else. Nobody's accomplished it yet. Maybe there's a couple people out there who are going, man, I'm just like, the best place. Mm-hmm. It's a tough give up. Because what happens is when we sit, we have to come right into this ultimate concern that we have. And so we might just come into pain and fear, into pain and fear, and this is painful and scared. I'm scared I'm not going to get to the right place. I'm scared that it's not going to be okay. I feel pain about all the bad things that have happened and that I don't understand. I don't like this ground. I don't want to be in this ground. This is too much pain, too much fear. I better think of a better place that I can get to that would be better than this place. And then the mind just proliferates into that. And so we could say the Buddha woke up to all of that. And he dismantled that. One could say he was a deconstructionist. He didn't invent or develop anything. He just kind of tore it all down. And realized that we all live in these mansions of fear, of pain, craving, ignorance. And we build these internal imaginative civilizations in our mind. That's the experience of being asleep. And so this ongoing practice of awareness, cultivation of awareness. And so when he would talk about what is it that we're trying to cultivate, this word citta, heart mind. And so that just there is this way in which we kind of get in trouble a little bit in our culture because we've separated cognition and emotion. We talk about thinking mind or our cognitive psychological experience and our emotional experience of kind of being different. Right? But I don't know if you've tried to notice or sit down and watch. It's really hard to experientially draw a line. Right? My thoughts are over there, my emotions are over here. Keep them separated. You can't really do it. I can't do it. I've tried. So this is not just this understanding, this waking up business. It's not about being clever or smart. It's part of it, perhaps. But suffering is not this thing that you can outsmart. You're going to figure it out. And this is again where this is why I think Brahma Vihara is such an important aspect. And I think it's been so troubling for me because that word just means nothing to me at all or to our culture. We would never think to dwell with Brahma. That's nothing that we would be interested in doing. And so I wish that the Buddhist tradition had done a better job of kind of cleaning that up for us. So we Brahma Viharas. And Brahma Vihara practice traditionally has kind of been taught as an aside. You know, as I sat retreats for years and years, it was Vipassana, 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 mindfulness, mindfulness, and maybe at 4 o'clock there'd be like a heart practice session or not. I would actually skip those sessions, but that's a whole different talk. I'm not doing that piece. But one of the things that the Buddha does often in his teachings is he takes ideas that were floating around in his time and place, and he just completely gives them a separate meaning. He says, actually, that's not what that is. This is what it is. Like karma, he redefines karma. He talks about awakening, which is something that no one else talks about. And he talks about if the goal of the practice or the goal of spiritual religious life is to dwell with Brahma, as the people of his time would say, he said, well, that actually means this. That means we have to develop human excellence. And really that's what I think the practice of awakening is about, is how well can human beings actually do? And so when we look at how can we practice in the relational sense or the relational field, that there is a understanding of how things are, the limitations of our experience, what we have agency over, what we don't have agency over, which that takes a little while to sort that game out right there. But really what we can do, the best we can do, I think, is when he talks about these Brahma Viharas, he's talking about the best we can expect. And the best we can expect is to develop kindness and to see the world and to see experience, to see ourselves in the world through the lens of a kind and friendly experience. And this is hard because much of my life I viewed the world as a very unsafe place. And the truth is, the world is kind of an unsafe place. For many people, it has been true. So it kind of can rock our sense of security by being asked to see things in a way that might seem unsafe or dangerous. But when we start to really try to cultivate this, and so good to hear in the meetings today and talking to you all. It's like, you know, we see internally we have this strong judgment and criticism and inner violence. And because the world is an unsafe place, that many of us see ourselves in a way that is really kind of harsh. not so kind. And so again, when we experience pain and fear in a very real way, we can't but help project ourselves into this place. I can't do this. And so we check out, or we imagine, or we consider, we try to broadcast ourselves into some other place. Well, you can't do that. And so that disconnect creates a sense of suffering. And so we have to come to terms with that. How that works, what we can expect to do. Recognizing that is not necessarily transformative or liberating. It can be actually aggravating and disappointing. When you get a big hit of like, oh my God, this is my mind? This is what it does all by itself. And so it does behoove us, or it can inspire us and encourage us to change the relational aspect of that. And that's that chitta, that heart mind, recognizing, meeting it with kindness, recognizing, seeing clearly, understanding, and then bringing something to the table of reality rather than just making demands on it. You know, because in each moment we sit down to the table, you know, of the present moment, and all we have is negotiations and demands about how things should be different, and if only, and what if. Right, so we kind of are asked to bring this metta quality and to abide. And actually, we have to cultivate a kind of internal sense of safety or ease or kindness, this internal quality. So in here, at least, is pretty good. And the strange thing I've noticed is that the better it gets in here, the out there actually seems a little bit better, too. I live in a much kinder world than I used to. I live in a much more friendly world than I used to. I actually feel safe in the world much of the time now. And I don't think the world has changed one iota in 24 years. Maybe it's gotten worse. I don't know. And so part of waking up is not just being aware and recognizing and understanding limitations and having realistic expectations. It's also about how we can meet ourselves in any particular moment in a way that ends that unnecessary suffering. And so metta has, in and of itself, transformative qualities. So it just starts with this benevolence or this kindness, this sense of ease, just trying to. Then there's so many different ways to talk about it, trying to be more generous with yourself in the present moment, more patient with yourself, more cooperative. You can't break down metta into just one word. It's so many different qualities are built into the fabric of that field or that foundation of the heart. And so then when the fear and the pain and the difficulty becomes too much for the metta, I was like, well, you know, I can't actually be at ease with this. This is too painful. Then compassion, metta can transform, and it can kind of take on that other kind of role, and it allows us to be held in that sense of care. And compassion is a very, very loaded term, I think. I feel like it's a great, beautiful term and concept, but I think we don't see that it can actually be very quite ordinary. It doesn't always have to be about the biggest struggle. It can be held in a very, very basic sense. And the Pali term that we end up with most of the time is karuna. But there's this other term that's used much more in the Buddhist teachings called anukampa, which means... it means a couple things. One, it means to cry out at the crying out of another. So it's about recognizing, like, oh my God, you're not doing so good. I'm kind of crying out with you. It's to feel with that experience. And interestingly enough, when the Buddha did wake up and he thought about his teachings and he thought about what he was going to teach or whether he was actually going to teach the Dharma, because in his own mind, And the stories, he thought, nobody's going to like want to hear this at all. Like, I'm just going to be, it's going to be tiring, it's going to be vexing for me, I'm going to be having to constantly explain myself to people. And he said, Anukampa, out of compassion for the world, is what actually inspired him to teach. And that there's a kind of a normalizing and a seeing that we're not just all by ourselves privately suffering in our own direct experience, like that everybody's doing this to some degree. It takes the sting out of it. Because in that place, that self becomes this kind of place that I'm in, my place, my difficult place, my past, my history, my suffering. Everybody else is doing great. Everybody else is having a really great time in this retreat. Nobody else is tired. I can see them, they're all just sitting there. The dude's not even moving. Everybody but me. I'm always the odd man out. You feel like that sometimes? How, you can't all get to be the odd man out. That's not even fair. And then it's not all about this suffering business either. You know, I feel like that's one of the things that often gets overly emphasized in the practice. But it's actually the other side of that coin is actually to have metta and a kindness and a friendliness for the joy in the world. There's so much joy and beauty and pleasure, and there's so much goodness out there. But again, we see that the mind, this is also, I think, part of the neurobiological makeup of our organism, is we do have this negative attention bias. That if I really get honest and I watch my mind, I'm just sitting here like, my attention is just waiting for the... okay, it's pretty good now, but any second now, your leg doesn't hurt right now, dude, but just wait. It's gonna hurt. There it goes. I'm out. I'm out. I knew it. Not so much in this retreat, but if you go to a retreat center, it's always walking down to breakfast, like, I know it's gonna be oatmeal. It's gonna be oatmeal. It's always oatmeal. It's like, damn it, there it is. It's like seeking the unpleasant. It's like this ironic thing that people say to you sometimes. I hope you find what you're looking for. It's like, dude, that's all you find. You always find what you're looking for. If you're looking for what's wrong, guess what you're gonna find? What's wrong? How long does it take to find out what's wrong about this moment? 3 or 4 seconds. I mean, do you ever sit there and think, no, I can't think of anything in my life that needs to be different? No, I'm just, all of it's just really so great. No, I'm just so happy with all of it. I'm just, you know, it's like, no, it's like that negative attention bias. We're drawn towards that. That's what we find what we're looking for. And so when we practice meditation, we practice cultivation, this cultivation is we're actually trying to override that and say, well, maybe can I look for the kindness? Can I look for the compassion? Can I look for the joy? Or do I just fall asleep into the strategy, that the hardware of the system? Right? That we do have a hardware in our system, which is the fight, flight, you know, lizard brain, dictated by that seeking for pleasure, trying to avoid pain, that really basic, so easy to default into that one. That's the hardware, unfortunately. And so we have to kind of practice with our software, you know, which is a little bit difficult, it's a little bit harder to deal with. You know, I like analog myself too. I'm kind of an analog guy, so I tend to fall back into my ancient, you know, not great contraption of my mind, because I don't want to practice. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to feel my emotions. I don't want to look at the disappointment. I don't want to cultivate joy and happiness and well-being because I'm so afraid I'm going to lose it if I get it. Why bother in the first place? It's going to be disappointed again. So it's like this story that the Buddha talks about. It's like the tree that grows in the field. If it leans to the west, it's going to fall to the west. When it finally goes down, it's going to go in that direction. If it leans to the east, it's going to fall to the east. So we're going to fall, and we're going to end up in whatever direction we lean. So if I'm leaning towards the suffering and the negativity and the hatred and the confusion and the stuckness in the place, then that's just where it's all headed. And I have agency over that. I'm not stuck with that. That's not determined. It's not predetermined. Or I can, and that's again, this is the paradox of becoming. Am I going to become that, or am I going to become well? And in every single moment, actually, we could say that we have this opportunity. If there's some degree of awareness, we can kind of choose which direction do I want to incline my mind and my heart towards, despite the fear and the pain and the disappointment. I'm like, well, every time I'm kind to people, they just take advantage of me. Or every time I, you know, like that kind of talking ourselves out of well-being. Because we don't deserve it. We're not going to get it anyway. What's the point? Why bother? Doubt. Which is interesting. We don't talk about doubt in the Western paradox or paradigm so much. We talk more about like sadness and anger and fear and those kinds of emotions. But the Buddha talked about doubt as being the most destructive force in the system. Mm-hmm. And doubt is the one thing that will actually, and I can give you many stories, I could give a whole discourse on how doubt has, you know, there's been years of time where I just stopped practicing altogether because of doubt. I'm like, this Dharma Buddhism stuff is not for me. I'm kind of more of a cocaine and Jack Daniels guy. Try that one out. And I actually done that. You know? Take my chances. So this kind of way we can cultivate this, and I don't know how you do it, that's the thing, is I think probably the most beneficial spiritual kind of emotional mental quality that we can develop is confidence, or trust we would say, or refuge we might even say. How do you internally cultivate a sense of, and it's just this basic quality of, I can do this, and just kind of one moment at a time, this doesn't seem unrealistic, actually. That's one thing I love about the Buddhist Dharma, is none of it seems unrealistic. It all makes pretty good sense. It all feels and seems to be fairly doable. But in every moment, I have that question of, am I going to incline in that direction, or am I just going to go back to sleep? Because it's nice to go to sleep sometimes, isn't it? There's a big old nap and just hatred and fear and confusion and shame. Take a big shame nap. Curl up with that. I'm just so bad and terrible. And nothing ever works out for me. And just, so uncomfortable. So that's the expectation, or I think the realistic expectation of all this, is trying to come to terms with some degree of authentic or realistic happiness that goes beyond having a place or destination that would be pleasant and agreeable and easy all of the time. Right? It's this willingness, this ongoing willingness to develop resources that can meet and overcome external demands. How well resourced are we? Because life, I don't know about you, my life has just been one external demand after another. The world is always demanding things from me. People, places, things, scenarios. So I want to be resourced in my relationships and my dealings with other people. I want to be resourced in my relationship with myself. so I can get through this thing with some degree of ease and confidence and realistic happiness. So that's what I have for you to consider this evening. So let's just maybe sit for a few minutes. Thank you for your attention.